I'm William Cooper, and you're listening to the Hour of the Time, once again. Well, folks, we continue with episode number 4 of the Legality of Taxes Symposium that was held recently in Washington, D.C. So make sure you have pen and paper by your side. Be prepared to take copious notes. And we have the 2-tape videotape set. If you would like to purchase it for $20 postpaid to your door. That's $20 postpaid to your door. It's 2 videotapes, a little over 3 hours in length, and you can get it from us by sending a blank money order or cash in the amount of $20 to the Hour of the Time in care of 101.1 FM, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. That's the Hour of the Time, in care of 101.1 FM, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. We also have these fantastic scanners, folks, and if you want one, you better get your money in here quick, because they're going to go fast. Had a whole bunch of calls today, people who wanted them. They wouldn't call last night, but they called today. Even so, we're not ordering any more base scanners. We can get the handheld, as many as you want, anytime you want, but the base scanners, we're not getting any more of those. If you want a base scanner, you better do it right now. Or you can go down to your local retail store and pay the full retail price, which is a lot of money. Okay, folks, get ready. Because here we go. Well, I don't know what's wrong, so I'm going to have to put on some music here and until I can figure it out, by cracky, and I will figure it out. Okay. While I figure this out, you listen to this music, and I'll be right back. Okay, folks, here it is.
Was that? There is no statute. Congress has passed no law compelling people, most of us, to file and pay taxes, direct taxes. So if the income tax goes down, because the people never really did ratify the income tax amendment, which means we're back to the original Constitution, unamended. We're back to, for instance, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4, which gave to Congress the power to tax the people in two ways, with indirect taxes, such as excise taxes, taxes on cigarettes and liquor and other things that we could avoid as an indirect tax, The Constitution also gave Congress the power to impose direct taxes, taxes we could not avoid, like an income tax. But Congress, when the people gave Congress that power, excuse me, in 1789, they did so with an important condition. Any direct tax that Congress was going to impose on the people had to be apportioned, meaning if California had 10% of the people, California had to come up with 10% of the revenue of that particular tax. Brilliant provision by the forefathers, making it extremely difficult for the federal government to impose direct taxes on us that we could not avoid. Direct taxes were not imposed on Americans. Congress tried in 1894, they passed a tax, an income tax, without apportionment, ignoring the Constitution. The Supreme Court, as Larry has pointed out, struck it down in 1895 in the Pollock case, saying it's not apportioned, it's unconstitutional. The forces who wanted an income tax didn't rest. Eventually in 1909, they prevailed upon Congress and got Congress to pass a proposed amendment to the Constitution to basically repeal the apportionment provision, allowing Congress to impose a direct tax on the people without apportionment. That became the proposed or the purported 16th Amendment, but it required three-fourths of the states to ratify it. And as we've learned, there's very strong evidence that Philander Knox, the Secretary of State, in 1913 committed fraud in proclaiming that it had been ratified. Well, this issue will be settled, I'm sure, eventually. But if the income tax goes down, or direct taxes go down, not just the income tax, but the Social Security tax, what then? Well, there are many other taxes, many other ways that Congress can tax the people indirectly, approaches to taxation that people can avoid. There are think tanks across the land that have, and politicians, statesmen that have been proposing tax reform for some time. One of the America's premier think tanks is the Heritage Foundation, and they have economists who have become experts on these various approaches to taxation, not just direct taxes, but indirect taxes as well. And we at the foundation, and of course this panel, we understand that if the income tax goes down, there may be a replacement, or there may have to be a replacement, of course. But our position is that's a political decision. That will be resolved through the give and take in society. Politics is consensus. The consensus may come down on a sales tax or an economic fee, a transaction tax, a land value tax, whatever. But this conference, this symposium, would not be complete, we don't think, without some discussion. We don't want to leave anyone in the audience the impression that we're for striking down, or anyone is for striking down, the income tax and recognizing the disorder that would follow if there was nothing to take its place. So let's now listen to one of the premier economists in the country, senior economist and fellow at the Heritage Foundation, talk to us about at least one of these alternatives. The sales tax, it's got some credibility on the Hill. There's been a bill introduced, I believe it was introduced on April 15th by Congressman Traficant and Towson. We're not endorsing that approach, but to give you some idea of what people are doing by way of tax reform, let's hear from Dan Mitchell, a senior fellow, a senior economist at the Heritage Foundation. Dan.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. And I want to welcome everyone here. I know a lot of you have come from outside of Washington, and so I wanted to add my welcome to Washington, D.C., America's work-free drug zone. And I want everyone to sort of stop and take a deep breath because there's a little bit of freedom in the air. Not quite yet, but Congress is about to go out on their 4th of July recess, or as they call it, a district work period. And since Will Rogers so aptly said that no man's life, liberty, and property are safe while the legislature is in session, I think we can shortly expect that no bad laws will be imposed upon us during that period when they are all out of town on their district work period. But I'm here to talk about what are the alternatives, what might happen if some of the events discussed by other panelists come to pass.
Folks, before you get all wrapped up in what you are about to hear, let me warn you. What Daniel Mitchell is about to propose is not only unconstitutional, but extremely dangerous to our freedoms. For those of you who know and understand the Constitution as I do, you will spot the unconstitutionality of this proposal instantly. And then as you listen to him as he goes along, you will also spot the danger. Tremendous danger to us all. I don't know how the Heritage Foundation can call this man what he has just been introduced to be. Unless, number one, none of them have studied the Constitution, and in truth, could not possibly know anything about it. Or number two, this is a subversive proposal meant to do the damage that if it ever becomes law, it is most certain to do. So pay attention to this and understand that a national sales tax or a flat tax is unconstitutional. And they've been talking about the unconstitutionality of it through this whole presentation. It's a direct tax. The federal government does not have the authority given to them by the Constitution to tax you at your cash register within the territorial boundaries of your state. They only have authority over interstate commerce and international commerce to levy excise taxes and only upon the first sale within that international or interstate commerce. So, if you don't understand all this, get out your copy of the Constitution and study it thoroughly. And listen to this guy and understand that he could be proposing this innocently, not understanding the limits placed upon the federal government by the Constitution for the United States of America, or he could be the enemy.
We have viewed, at the Heritage Foundation, we have viewed the tax system through a prism of the Constitution, not in the sense of the issue talked about here, but in the sense that we believe that a tax system should fulfill the Constitution's promise of equal treatment under the law. In other words, the law should apply equally to all. Now, what this means is that there should be no special treatment or subsidy or reward for some people who happen to have a special access to the powerful in Washington, and neither should there be any special penalty imposed upon those who happen to be in disfavor among the elites in Washington. And that means that you should have a system that doesn't penalize you on the basis of how you earn your income. It shouldn't penalize you on the basis of how you spend. And it shouldn't penalize you on the basis of the level of income or wealth or consumption that you have. You want the law to treat everyone equally. And what does that mean? It means that whatever your tax code is, it should tax economic activity only one time. I mean, it's bad enough to give the government one bite at the apple, don't give them twice, and then tax at one rate. And if you have a tax code that fulfills those two very simple principles, you're going to have something that, as an economist, I would love to drone on endlessly about how that's going to be good for our economy. But perhaps even more importantly, from a moral and from a philosophical and a constitutional perspective, we will have satisfied the notion of equal treatment under the law. Now, much of what the Heritage Foundation has done within the guidelines of those principles has been to work on the flat tax. But what happens if, knock on wood, good news happens, and somehow the courts or the politicians say, well, you can't have any direct tax on income, and that means even a simple, fair, low-rate income tax like a flat tax can't happen. What does that mean? Well, fortunately, there is more than one way to skin the cat. Now, mind you, when you were up here talking earlier, Bob, you know, what would happen if the income tax went away, I do briefly get tempted to think that we could somehow survive, as this country survived from 1776 to 1913 with neither a sales tax or an income tax, but I guess I'm maybe a little old-fashioned. I mean, if we didn't have any kind of big, broad-based tax, we might not have any money to give to corrupt socialist governments to prop up their economies around the world. We might not be able to pay people to have children out of wedlock and destroy families in the inner city. We might not have money for a Department of Education that bogs down teachers with red tape so they have a harder time educating our kids. And so, of course, I guess we do need some revenue source so the government can continue to carry out all these very important functions. Well, what is the alternative? There is an alternative that I think very clearly satisfies those principles that I laid out earlier, and that's a national sales tax. Now, before I tell you what a national sales tax is, let me tell you what it isn't. Because if I tell you what it isn't, that's going to tell you that it's a pretty good idea. First of all, it's not 17,000 pages of code and regulations that accompany our income tax. And this, by the way, doesn't include all the tax court decisions and IRS letter rulings. It is not 5.5 million words, many of them inconsistent with each other, that define our current income tax code and regulations. It is not the 569 different forms that our current income tax requires that are available on the IRS's own webpage. And to give you actually an idea of how bad the system is, like I just can't resist, this is one of my, I guess it's not a favorite anecdote, maybe it's least favorite anecdote. In 1997, Money Magazine sent a hypothetical family's tax return to professional tax preparers, CPAs, people who presumably knew what they were doing. They got back 45 answers. All 45 were different. All 45 were wrong. And fewer than 1 in 4 were even within $1,000 of the right answer. And by the way, who even knows whether Money Magazine's panel of experts came up with the right answer? And this actually caused a little bit of a stir in Washington. Our elected officials got right to business. And they passed the 1997 Taxpayer Relief Act. Well, I think the only relief it gave was to tax lawyers and accountants, because that one law created 285 new sections of tax law and amended 824 others. And so when Money Magazine in 1998 did the same survey of sending out a hypothetical family's tax return, and remember, hypothetical family, not General Motors, not Bill Gates, but a hypothetical family. This time, they got back 46 answers. Once again, all 46 were different from each other, and all 46 were wrong. And this time, instead of just 1 in 4 being within $1,000 of the alleged correct answer, the closest answer to the alleged correct answer was off by $610, and the average mistake was more than $5,000. That's the tax code that we have today. This is what a national sales tax would not be. And by the way, of course, I love the fact that under our current tax code, that your normal constitutional protections do go out the window. You are presumed guilty until you prove yourself innocent. So in other words, you have fewer constitutional protections than Timothy McVeigh and O.J. Simpson and everyone else out there who robs, kills, rapes, murders, pillages, you name it. Of course, I guess what the IRS does is pillages, but I'll try to keep those editorial comments out of here. So that's what a national retail sales tax is, and what is it? What it is very simple. And I'll just assume that it's a 20% rate. You know, obviously the rate would depend on the size of the government. But since I'm not a math genius, let's keep 20% in case I have to do any calculations. a 20% tax on all final consumer purchases of goods and services. Now, this is a little bit different than what you're probably familiar with if you're from one of the 45 states with a sales tax. Everything would be taxed. In most states, for instance, you don't tax services. In most states, you have special penalties on some products like tobacco that are viewed as politically incorrect. But the view of a national retail sales tax is that we want to fulfill that constitutional promise of equal treatment, and so you don't want special subsidies for some products or services, special penalties imposed on others. So one flat, low rate imposed on all final consumer purchases. Why do I say final consumer purchases? Why not purchases from one business to another? You don't tax purchases from one business to another because that causes cascading and double taxation. And it creates an incentive then for businesses to become just giant vertically integrated conglomerates. And the example that I will give you that I think makes the most sense, at least to me, is that if we tax the sale from the tree farmer, I guess, I don't know what you call tree farmers, but the tree farmer to the lumber mill, and then you tax again the transaction from the lumber mill to the furniture maker, and then you tax the transaction from the furniture maker to the wholesaler, and then again from the wholesaler to the retailer, and then you levy another tax at the level of the retailer, guess what? You're taxing the one product that the consumer buys at the end, what, five or six times? And that would obviously create a huge incentive for one company to simply vertically integrate and have all of those operations under one roof. And we don't want the tax code to be dictating how the economy is functioning. We want the tax code to do one thing and one thing only. Collect whatever amount of money the government demands, hopefully a small amount, but that's up to the political process, and to do so in a way that is going to be as least intrusive and as least damaging and as least distortionary to the economy while also fulfilling the promise of treating all citizens equally under the law. What sort of compliance would you have with the National Retail Sales Tax? You, as an individual, would have none. Zip. Nada. No more tax system for you. The closest you come to a tax system as a consumer, as an individual, under a National Retail Sales Tax, is you buy products. And there's a tax that's part of that product. And by the way, it's very important that tax should be visible. You don't want to make the mistake that the European socialist stagnant economies have made with value-added taxes that are built into the price of a product. And so when you buy it, you don't know how much the government is taking from you. Whereas if you have a very clear national retail sales tax where it's on your cash register receipt that you pay 20% more because the government wants to spend this money, then you have a way of deciding, is this price that I'm paying too much for government? Is government giving me 20 cents on the dollar worth of goods and services? Now, I would think the answer would be no, and we'd put pressure to bring that rate down. But again, that's a question for the political process. So you would have nothing to do with the tax code as an individual. If you're a business, you would basically do what you do now if you're in one of the 45 states with a sales tax, except it would be much simpler because you wouldn't have to calculate, you know, which products have taxes and which products don't. You would simply collect 20% on everything you sell. You would submit a monthly statement or form to the tax collection authority. And by the way, you could have this tax collection authority actually done at the state level, or you could have it be done federally. The sales tax legislation that has been offered and discussed in Washington proposes to give a commission for states to actually be the collection agency. And so you wouldn't even need anything remotely resembling the IRS that we have now in Washington. And that literally is it. I mean, I'd love to, to talk for another hour explaining all the details and intricacies of a national retail sales tax, but there aren't any. We can have a simple tax code if we make a decision that we want to get politicians out of the business of trying to steer our behavior and micromanage the economy. And we can have a simple tax code if we decide that we want a tax system that treats everyone equally. All the complications, all the mess, all the distortions that we have with our current income tax all exist because we have deviated from those principles. And so it's really up to us. Do we want the simplicity? Do we want the fairness? And if we don't get rid of the 16th Amendment, you can get that through a flat tax, or you can get it through a sales tax, and you certainly would only get it through a sales tax if we can somehow get rid of the 16th Amendment. And actually, I do want to give one word of caution. just getting rid of the 16th Amendment, I fear, is not enough, because we won that case in 1895, the Pollock case, but only by a 5-4 vote. And that was back when the Supreme Court justices probably knew there was such a thing as the Constitution. I worry that if you say, oh, well, the Constitution already gives us the right to levy an income tax, that decision back in 1895 was a mistake. So I encourage all of us, let's not just fight to put the 16th Amendment 6 feet under the ground in a lead-lined casket surrounded by concrete with salt over the earth. Let's try to put something in the Constitution making it unambiguously clear, so clear that even David Souter can't rule otherwise, that an income tax can never come back to haunt America. Let me go ahead and close, I guess, on an optimistic note. Again, there's not a whole lot more to discuss on a sales tax because it's so simple. I actually think that even if we don't succeed, why do I say this? I say this because of the Internet. And it's not for the reason that was discussed earlier, that information is more freely available. I mean, I think that's great. The American people do have a chance through the Internet of finding things that the elites don't want them to know. But I think the beauty of the income tax of the Internet from the perspective of the income tax is that with each passing year, it is becoming harder and harder and harder for the Internal Revenue Service to enforce a tax code that is so fundamentally broken and corrupt. Just go to one of those search engines and type in tax shelter. And frankly, the number of replies you get will be dictated simply by whatever the maximum capacity is of that server, whether they give you 10,000 replies, 100,000 replies. It used to be that rich people, that the income tax was largely voluntary for rich people in the sense that they could always go to Bermuda, the Cayman Islands, Hong Kong, Netherlands Antilles, the Isle of Man. There are all sorts of places that rich people have always been able to go to hide their income. And when they said that we need to have higher tax rates to soak the rich, but of course it actually turns out that the supply-siders were right all along. You lower tax rates and the rich wind up paying more because they find it all of a sudden it's not as profitable for them to hide their money overseas and to hide their money in tax shelters. But the point is that the tax shelters and the tax havens and the ways to protect income and assets that used to be a exclusive preserve of the rich are now increasingly becoming more and more something that's available to the average American. Now, I'm not saying you should obey those laws, assuming they are moral and just laws. And when you have a tax system that is as bad as the one we have now, and individuals are being able to hide their money and evade the responsibilities they have under the law, that simply creates a more and harder to get that same amount of money. And that, to me, is why I am hopeful, I won't guarantee it by any means, but I am hopeful that the fact that it is becoming increasingly easy for people to hide their money